Hello and welcome to Following the Rules. This is a podcast about the rules shaping UK and EU financial services and the people responsible for understanding and implementing them. Because in one of the world's most regulated sectors, following the rules isn't always easy. I'm your host, financial journalist Lucy McNulty, and every episode I'll be asking the most influential personalities in financial regulation for their input on the sector's most pressing issues.
A lot of firms in the markets, they're going to be in a really scary position where the regulator knows more about the firm's business and can look into its data in a more revealing way than the firm does itself.
Today's episode is a special one, produced in association with Global Relay, a technology firm providing global financial services companies with the software to capture, store, and monitor their employees' communications. Today's guest discusses how financial institutions in the US and UK are responding to regulatory pressures to more closely track their employees' communications, as well as to foster operational resilience and promote good conduct amongst their staff. He explains why one particular compliance tool is proving especially effective in helping firms promote good behaviour amongst their workforce, and outlines how some finance bosses are starting to push back on regulators' aggressive record-keeping clampdown. He also offers guidance on how financial institutions can best use technology to address their emerging compliance risks, including a checklist of essential questions he believes everyone should ask any prospective regulatory technology provider. Alex Vial is the Chief Strategy Officer at Global Relay. Hi, Alex. Welcome to Following the Rules.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
Regular listeners will be familiar with Global Relay as a technology firm, but could you give us a run through of your role within the company?
I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at Global Relay. I've been there for about 3.5 years now, and I work mainly in London, and I also increasingly spend time in New York. We had an existing office in New York, but we've opened a new one. I have a pretty diverse set of responsibilities at Global Relay that go beyond pure strategy. I oversee the London office. So we have 535 people in the heart of the city, and that number is growing. We're actually trying to get a new floor because we need space for another 100 people. We're always hiring engineering talent, and we are starting to increase our business development side. And I also play a big role in helping manage our business development globally. So there's a project that I started just over a year ago called GRIP. GRIP stands for Global Relay Intelligence and Practice, and it's basically free regulatory change information. It's at grip.globalrelay.com. And I'm very close to my network of compliance, operational, and regulatory contacts that I've built up over the last 30 years. So I started out in regulation as a graduate, actually, at the SFA, the UK regulator, back in 1989. And then I became a supervisor before going into banking as a compliance officer. And from there, I stepped out during the dot-com craze and built a compliance software company, co-founding Complinet, which was a 13-year journey to exit. We sold the business to Thomson Reuters in 2010. 10 of those years I spent actually building the business in New York. So I got to know the regulators and the regulatory environment and the markets there very well. I then worked for various big data analytics businesses before I found Global Relay.
You've mentioned that you're adding a new office in New York and adding 100 staff into your London office. What's driving business growth?
There's a tailwind behind what we're seeing from a regulatory enforcement perspective. So the regulators in the US are particularly aggressive around record keeping. That plays well to our business. We're seeing a lot of firms asking for more services from less vendors. And that also works well for the extensive offering that we have. And we're finding that because of our legacy in the business, it's our 25th anniversary this year, we're seeing a lot of demand for the sort of services that we offer end to end, from the original capture all the way through the monitoring and surveillance piece to the app we have that allows you to communicate, whether it's by text, WhatsApp, email, voice, any of those. And it's device agnostic as well. We're finding that that is becoming very appealing. So all of those things are driving growth for us. And we see a big opportunity in North America. There's an interesting period coming up in terms of the strict liability that the US regulators are placing around record keeping. A great example would be the fine that JP Morgan picked up last month for trade surveillance issues and gaps in data related to venues that JP Morgan was using. And regulators are being much more aggressive in terms of the compliance that they're expecting. So I think that is a real challenge for firms. And there's also a technological tailwind, whether it's artificial intelligence, whether it's the increasing number of data types that can be captured and used, whether for analytics or simply something that the regulators are going to demand as well. So voice, video, different platforms, the metadata attached to it, trading apps. There's an interesting tension around the regulations and what regulators can demand, in the sense that they can say, well, this is all related to your business, this is all related to your trading, therefore it's records that you should be offering up to us. And there's going to be a clash. We're starting to see firms pushing back against some of the things that the Gensler administration is asking for.
Could you elaborate on that? What type of pushback are you seeing?
A lot of firms are saying the SEC is going above and beyond its requirement and is asking for too much. And we are being asked to supply data and information that the regulator has no right to ask for. The difference between US regulation and the rest of the world is that US regulation is incredibly prescriptive, and it comes down to very hard and fast rules and laws. And I think that they will be contested in court in certain instances. And a great example might be perhaps voice records, where the regulator will argue that they want to receive voice files. And unless you're a swaps dealer in the US, there is no requirement to do that. And I think a lot of firms will say you're not legally obliged to look at that in order to do your job as regulator.
Okay. And what's been the regulator's response to these comments that they're asking too much, or this reluctance to hand over information they're requesting?
The regulators don't tend to conduct PR campaigns. They just do what they do. This will all come out in the way enforcement actions are processed in the next 18 months, and also what people see and hear during examinations by the regulator.
The US is having an election in November, which could see a change of president. In the US, that will mean that the heads of various regulators will also change. You are anticipating a clash. It hasn't necessarily come to fruition yet, but would you expect that clash to happen before the election?
I think it will do, because Chair Gensler needs to try and get as much established as he possibly can in case he is not the incumbent in November. So I think that record-keeping drive is going to be pushed through quite forcefully in the next 6 to 8 months.
And there have been, over the recent years, a number of large fines levied against US banks for WhatsApp use, but actually nothing egregious was found in the WhatsApps in question. The regulatory action was because the banks were found to be in breach of record-keeping rules. They weren't gathering this data to the extent that the regulators, Gensler, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, would have liked to see.
The US has strict liability around its record-keeping. It doesn't matter what is in the record in the US. If you are not capturing, then that is a breach of the rules, and you could probably expect enforcement. Whereas the UK have confirmed they take a more risk-based approach, and it really depends where you're doing your business and how much. It's all proportionate. That's certainly the difference between US and non-US regulation around record keeping.
Okay. If you could summarize the top three concerns of your clients currently, what would they be?
Well, we've covered record keeping, whether that's from the communication side, but also trade surveillance. That's top of the list at the moment. In the UK, conduct is a big issue at the moment. Certainly the FCA is making non-financial misconduct or financial misconduct a big focus, and that covers senior executives as well. There's going to be more and more focus on that. So that's a key one. Cyber and operational resilience have to be very, very high on the list in terms of risks and the growing demands for effective operational resilience and compliance with new regulations that are undefined at the moment. Those would be the ones that would be very high on the list. There are emerging regulatory areas, whether that be crypto, the use of artificial intelligence, and even ESG, and those rules, which are all very inconsistent globally and lacking precedent, all of those areas would be of concern at the moment.
Okay. And obviously on the operational resilience point, the EU has its Digital Operational Resilience Act, which is due to take effect from early 2025. So what's your view on that rule set? What are clients' views on the ease with which they can comply with that?
People are still waiting for guidance around those. They make a lot of sense, but to some extent, there's denial about what a substantive impact they're going to have. I would argue that it will actually be a considerable challenge for the technology companies that service the big institutions. So I think that institutions will try and push compliance towards their providers, which will be fascinating to see which ones are best placed from a security perspective and from a resourcing perspective to ensure that every part of an institution's supply chain is compliant with those acts. That's going to be one of the biggest challenges. It plays to the bigger technology companies' strength. And we're going to see equivalent approaches to DORA in the UK and the US. It feels almost like a GDPR standard will be imitated and used globally, because it's probably necessary.
And the GDPR refers to the EU's data protection rules, which had huge extraterritorial reach when they came into effect. And operational resilience obviously relates to firms' abilities to keep operating in the event of a disaster. And that's why there's a lot of focus on those that they outsource business to, because they need to be certain that their business can operate in that eventuality, but also that those they rely on for technological services can also continue to operate in that situation. Of those pain points that you've referenced, is there one specific area where finance bosses are making the most mistakes in their approach to managing the emerging risks, or where you believe that the emerging risks are most misunderstood? And how can that be remedied, if so?
Well, cyber is incredibly hard to feel comfortable about. However much you devote resource to it, you can always feel that you're never doing enough. And it's a huge threat. Many of the instances are not well publicized for various reasons. It feels a little bit like an iceberg. We only see the top of the challenge there. I'm all for technology. It can be a huge advantage to organizations, but it also offers up considerable threats. So that's a really, really tough one that senior management are not aware enough of. Another one, reputation management for individual executives, especially senior executives, and for a firm is a very, very crucial one. People underestimate the almost fatal damage that can be done to a firm and a brand if reputation is not respected and controlled. So that's something that firms need to have a better hold of, in particular, the way social media can be used now to perhaps start a run on a bank. You look at what happened to Silicon Valley Bank and the way that company's business model was torn to shreds, really, in a very short space of time. A lot of firms and executives perhaps underestimate the impact that social media can have. Another one that's really interesting is cloud services. I'm all for cloud services, but for a lot of senior execs, the full extent of the cost of cloud services that they're committing to is not understood at this stage. And the real costs around cloud services from the big tech companies and the risks around concentration of data and concentration in performance from some of these big providers is being addressed by regulations around operational resilience. That is going to play out over the next 2 to 3 years, where people start to appreciate quite what they're getting and perhaps feeling that that is not the value that they expected previously.
There was a rush amongst financial services firms to use cloud services a number of years ago now. There was a focus on a handful of providers. And so you found there was almost a too big to fail problem, because a number of the largest financial institutions in the world were using the same cloud service providers. So there was an operational risk there. Is that what you're referring to?
That's exactly it, Lucy. You've hit the nail on the head. People are now starting to realize that if there is a significant outage at one of these companies and that is their only provider in certain critical services, then it's going to be very risky for the market. So that's exactly what I was alluding to. The regulators are starting to say that they will actually formally regulate critical third parties. So it's going to be very interesting to see who falls into that definition and also how they respond to being regulated in a way that they never have. This is essentially software businesses being regulated in the same way that perhaps a bank has been regulated previously. It will also be interesting to see from a supervisory perspective the way that regulators push certain institutions towards having parallel services, having backups to providers. And there's going to be a conflict there because if you look at the way some of the big cloud providers are positioning themselves at the moment, they're trying to wrap up certain institutions, getting them to commit for very long terms with large amounts of money. And that is appealing in terms of cost savings, but it's also hugely anti-competitive. So it's going to be fascinating to see the extent to which it is enforced and regulated. That's a big change.
Mm-hmm. We've discussed the risks that can arise from use of technology in the compliance and regulatory space, but what role can technology play in addressing some of these emerging risks that we've discussed?
Well, technology is the ability to be an amazing training tool and also essential for control. And firms need to be investing as much in their tech or more than the regulators that they have. It's amazing how the regulators have invested in technology over the last 10 years. And they don't have limitless budgets, but they've invested very wisely in order to help their ability to supervise markets and firms. If you look at the way data has become more available and more transparent, I think that the combination of technology and that data availability makes regulators much more effective. And a lot of firms in the markets need to make a similar investment and have equivalent tools to the regulators, or they're going to be in a really scary position, which is where the regulator knows more about the firm's business and can look into its data in a more revealing way than the firm does itself. And that's a phenomenon. We're probably at an inflection point right now. So if you look at the way regulators are supervising, they're doing it with more precision and they're asking for very specific data sets. They're using their tools to analyze trends in the market, to analyze certain firms. So we're seeing a lot more targeted supervision. We have to talk about AI. AI is hugely exciting. Employed efficiently, it can save a huge amount of cost. It can improve productivity in terms of compliance, but also client provision. We've been talking about AI for probably 10 years, but the advances in generative AI in the last 18 months and the availability of large language models in a market-wide fashion is going to significantly change the market and the approach and the ability of firms to handle all of these risks. So that is very, very exciting.
And you mentioned generative AI, which is the content generating AI technology underpinning ChatGPT, among other tools. And it's something that a lot of financial institutions are focused on now in terms of how best to grasp the opportunities that that kind of technology represent in the most responsible way. It's quite a challenge for the industry, but an exciting one. Are there any common mistakes that firms make when looking for a technological solution to a compliance risk? And if so, what are they and how can they be avoided?
Yes, there are many. There are some very obvious questions that firms need to ask in terms of the vendor they're getting involved with. A lot of it comes down to regulatory knowledge and does the provider that you have the subject matter expertise? Have they been shoulder to shoulder in the trenches with other firms, with your peer firms, when something goes wrong? And things do go wrong. One of the crucial things you need to do is to run a proof of concept to check that the technology that you're thinking you want to invest in actually works in your environment and on your data. There are a lot of technology companies that are very good at selling. Everything looks and sounds good in PowerPoint, but actually run it on your own data. That's an essential step that you have to take. Ask your peers, does the firm you're interested in have the pedigree and will the system scale with your business in terms of where it's going? A lot of technology companies also are on a short journey to exit. So they might be starting out and have an aggressive roadmap to be sold to a much bigger company in 3 to 5 years' time. That can be incredibly disruptive. and often they are distracted along the way. One of the areas where we see huge mistakes is purely judging technology on the price. Often firms will make a decision, go with the cheapest option, which might not be as compliant. There might be hidden costs. And similarly, you have to have experience in terms of security. Does the firm that you're going with have any certification that proves it is actually going to improve your operational resilience and that you aren't going to have a data breach and data gaps? All of these things are crucial in the evaluation process. You need to add all of those things up to come with a very rounded evaluation of the technology that you're going with.
You mentioned non-financial misconduct, and this has been something that the UK's Financial Conduct Authority has said that it's going to focus on for quite some time. It defines non-financial misconduct as regulated city workers' misbehaviour outside of the day job. And for the FCA to take action, it's behaviour that would need to call into question the individual's fitness and propriety to do their role. The FCA has long been saying it will focus more on this, but recently it's taken quite proactive steps to actually do that. And you mentioned that there are instances in which the regulators will have more information to their hands about individual financial institutions than the institutions themselves. And non-financial misconduct is the perfect example of that. The FCA has instigated some studies into certain sectors of the UK's financial market, and it's asked institutions within those sectors to provide extensive information as to examples of particular non-financial misconduct taking place within their firms. And just providing that information could be quite challenging for some of those institutions. They will not have been tracking that to the extent the regulators might expect to date.
The market is starting to ask for more definitive guidance, and that has been coming out. The FCA wrote a Dear CEO letter to the Lloyd's wholesale insurance market, asking for fairly generic data around the amount of incidents of non-financial misconduct. So this was a shot across the bows, so to speak. That Dear CEO letter was the most definitive thing that I have seen from the FCA. And we had an event with FCA where the head of market supervision was talking about this as a theme and said, this is not just about the insurance market. We're going to be asking the same across other sectors. And we have seen the regulator stating that they believe that this is all part of their assessment of compliance culture, and that they believe that if non-financial misconduct is tolerated in certain areas or is prevalent, that it will naturally flow that there will be other parts of the business where there is non-compliance, where the business is not being run appropriately, and that they will use that as an indicator for the need for them to be more intrusive in their supervision, because they think that these things are all related. So they've definitely made a strong stand on how they feel about this, and that it is something where the market really needs to take notice. This is not going away. This is how the FCA believes it needs to regulate.
Mm-hmm. And I recently spoke with Global Relay's Rob Mason about financial services companies' preparations for this clampdown on financial services workers' misbehaviour outside of the day job. And as part of that, Rob mentioned that he could envisage a regulatory clampdown on employees' social media use, amongst other things. He predicted that financial services compliance teams could soon ask finance workers to disclose their social media details to them as part of financial institutions' preparations for this increasing regulatory interest in employees' non-financial misconduct. And of course, Global Relay recently surveyed 10,000 bank, broker-dealer, fund managers and other regulated financial services firms on their approach to monitoring employee communications. And one key finding from that report was that not enough financial services companies were tracking their employees' use of social media sites such as LinkedIn. And therefore, social media sites like that represented a compliance risk to those finance firms that had left them unmonitored. You've mentioned the use of social media to bring down Silicon Valley Bank. What is the right approach to this compliance risk in your view, and how would you like to see finance firms and their regulators address the risks posed by social media?
Going back to what we were talking about in terms of being risk-based and being proportionate, I think that's probably the right approach. We get into dangerous territory here where respecting the balance between someone's corporate life and their personal life, there has to be a line there that's established. So from a privacy perspective, the use of LinkedIn is professional, but it's very personal. I'm not saying that people don't use that to make contact with people in the corporate world, but in terms of their ability to conduct trading or anything more nefarious, I think the risks are probably minimal. But going back to what we were talking about in terms of strict liability in the US, it might be something that some firms don't want to take that risk because of the regulatory penalties around it. In terms of how you deal with those situations, this is where compliance training is crucial. It's an area where if you were doing your regular compliance training, you have to start talking about this. I always like war stories. You can say, here is a peer of yours who is no longer able to work in this industry because they were found to be using social in a collusive way. So that's a crucial thing for firms to do, document the training. Increasingly, attestation is being used in areas like this from a market standard perspective. Firms are now getting executives to attest that they're complying with policies related to social use on a quarterly basis. And the other area is create a corporate environment where individuals have all of the tools that they need to trade, to report, to communicate efficiently. We're seeing a lot of firms starting to use corporate issued devices more. I think there's a big move away from bring your own device. A lot of firms use BYOD as a policy because it was less expensive, but they're now saying actually there's a risk with that. Global Relay has an app which is compliant, which is flexible. It allows you to send WhatsApp, to send texts, to use voice and email, all in a compliant wrapper on your phone. And it's very close to consumer style apps. It's crucial to ensure that an executive can do their job, but we respect this difference between their work life and their personal life.
You mentioned the shift from bring your own device to use of corporate issued devices, and obviously that would enable the financial institution reissuing those corporate devices to pay closer attention to how those devices are being used and ensure that they're complying with the record keeping requirements in their jurisdictions, therefore. And it's worth saying that the Global Relay study that I mentioned found that a third of the 10,000 survey respondents were monitoring their employees' use of LinkedIn, but they were doing that because employees had given them permission to do that. And that's worthwhile flagging up that where firms are monitoring LinkedIn use, it's because employees have specifically said they can. It would be a significant issue if firms were monitoring these personal sites without employees' permission in most jurisdictions. You mentioned attestations and the increasing use of that. Are you able to elaborate a little bit more on that? Where are you seeing that?
Yes, attestations are increasingly popular. We've seen their use has increased in the last 18 months. A lot of firms have gone from not using attestations to asking for them once a year. And in the last 6 months, we've been hearing people say that they're doing them quarterly. It's not necessarily an insurance policy, but it helps to engage dialogue from a behavior perspective. Attestations have had a very positive impact. They're considered non-intrusive in terms of respecting privacy and the ability for the individual and the corporate to have a good consensual relationship. It's a huge preference for your higher risk employees in terms of their ability to commit market abuse. So the trading environment, people who are working with big customers and firms in the market, they're the ones that are being focused on most with attestation. It's across all firms. We haven't seen any particular sector where they are most popular. And we work with a huge variety of companies from broker-dealers and banks, traditional asset managers, hedge funds, private equity. We work with insurance companies, and this is global. It's particularly popular with hedge funds. They're regular users of attestation, but other parts of the industry are really catching on to its value. And we're seeing it much more aggressively in the US than in the UK. It allows the firm to show willing to a regulator as long as they're done thoroughly, regularly, and they're complete and records are kept. It also means that a lot of individuals have started to volunteer instances where they have perhaps inadvertently breached a policy. So the attestation serves as a reminder of what's important and what the policy is. And it means that people then come forward and say, I sent this WhatsApp. I know it was against policy. This was the reason behind it. So that is working incredibly well.
What kind of information is required when an individual is signing an attestation? Would they, for instance, be required to disclose their social media handles?
It's a very flexible tool in the sense that you can leave the attestation to be very generic and very vague. you're then leaving a much wider catchment area for the individual in terms of what they're signing. I think where it is most valuable is being very specific. So you actually use the attestation as a training tool to remind the individual of the areas of real risk that your internal policies cover. And I think a lot of the firms have been reading the enforcement actions and reading the things that the regulators have said have not been complied with, and they're using that as their base for the attestation list.
Okay. And you mentioned it's most popular in the US. Do you expect the UK to follow?
We are seeing UK firms using it. I wouldn't say it's used as much as it is in the US because we haven't seen an equivalent enforcement aggression here in the UK. But I think that it will naturally start to become more widely used because it is deemed as a vital control tool. And it gives the firm and its stakeholders a lot of comfort to have this in place. It's really allowing firms to take control. The problem, which we all know with off-channel communications, is that because technology has changed so much, a lot of these breaches are generally innocent. They're driven by the need to do business. You're being asked to communicate. You might be away, or you're being asked by a new client who's demanding a certain channel that they want to communicate with. A lot of these things are really beyond the control of the compliance and the compliance technology team in terms of capture. But a tool like this can allow you to get ahead of that and surface it. And someone might say, oh, well, actually, I'm looking at my attestation and I realized that I did this. It's a really good way for firms to tackle the growing problem of off-channel communication abuse, which, as I said, is in 99% of the time is innocent, but it hasn't stopped US regulators coming down very, very hard.
It does sound like it's a very effective tool to remind your senior staff of the policies around social media use that are in place and to ensure that they are adhering to those.
There's been an overhaul done at pretty much every firm that we know in terms of their compliance with record keeping. And these are the extra controls that work very effectively and they make sense. It actually engenders a better relationship between the individual and their employer. It's protecting the individual as well as the firm at the same time. We've seen negotiations around the ability for firms to actually seize an individual's phone. Obviously, there's no right under EU privacy regulation to do that. We have seen certain instances where individuals have come to a contractual relationship with their firms to allow that handover to happen. But that's only in very extreme cases that we've seen firms put that in place. This is a much milder and more sensible version of that.
Can an individual be fired if they are found to have gone against the policies that they have attested that they've complied with?
Absolutely. And we've seen it at all levels in terms of very senior people being very publicly let go. It shows to the regulator how seriously firms are taking this. If firms have to publish that and to make it very obvious, but that's a fairly severe piece of action. The key thing that we have seen in terms of the change in behavior and what regulators expect as this record keeping drive has rolled out is that there has to be an internal disciplinary remedial procedure that the firm has and that they have to follow it. So what a regulator would expect to see is that action is taken. In the early days, we saw some fairly aggressive firm responses in terms of discipline. A number of people were asked to leave certain institutions for breaching this policy. Were they an example for everyone else? Probably. But that is definitely something that you have to have in place and you have to follow it. And it has to be proportionate and reasonable. And that is what regulators are expecting right now.
So would your advice to UK clients scrambling now to prepare for the FCA's expected clampdown on employees' non-financial misconduct to consider using an attestation to make sure that their employees are not doing anything inappropriate on social media?
Attestation is a great way of doing that. That does make sense. And that might be the best way for firms to collect the data. that the regulator is starting to ask to see. The FCA requested numbers of instances of reports, complaints, anything related to non-financial misconduct. This is a relatively new ask, and a number of firms will not have this information, and attestations may be a way for firms to start capturing the incidents that the FCA is asking for transparency about. So saying, please confirm to me you haven't behaved in this way in the last 12 months, or it's another way of collecting that information. But there's a certain amount that you can expect an employee to be able to attest to. There's a boundary over which you probably can't go. Your personal life, that's a sensible boundary. Anything that can be related to your business, then the regulator probably has a right to say that there's a standard of conduct that applies to that. But I think external to that, it's really going beyond to expect individuals to self-regulate when they're not in a corporate sphere.
Okay. And lastly, what action points do you like listeners to take away from this conversation?
Oh my goodness. So I get to preach to everyone, Lucy, which is great. So here are what I think the big takeaways. So I actually think the macro risks are much bigger for firms now. If I think about the way firms are supervised and regulated and the compliance teams they have, the wholesale sector is much better supervised, and in terms of conduct is in a much better place than it was 20 years ago. But it's the external shocks that, you know, going back to Silicon Valley Bank and what happened to them, it's very hard to risk manage those things. Artificial intelligence is game changing. Compliance is growing all the time in terms of its demand. Our jobs are about to change hugely with generative AI. The one error I see firms making again and again, and if you look at probably 80% of the enforcement actions, it's where the firm has been supervised and they've come in and looked at their policies and procedures and said, okay, show us you are following these, and they're not following them. That's really crucial. People have to be really wary of record keeping. They have to be aware that almost anything that you do now, whether you say it, whether you're on video, whether you're sending a text, it is discoverable. And you have to apply a permanent lens to that and think, okay, if this is repeated to me in a courtroom in 5 years' time, am I going to be happy with what I'm saying here? Am I going to be able to defend myself? Because the technology allows us to communicate very, very quickly. And sometimes we do it without thinking. The culture of compliance at the firm you work at is absolutely crucial. You need to hold a mirror up to your firm and say, is this a good culture of compliance? And if it's not, you probably need to think about moving on, because there are still firms that say getting fines is a cost of us doing business. And that's not the right approach. So that's it, Lucy. Preaching over.
Well, there's lots there for listeners. Thank you very much for your time today. It's been a really informative conversation.
No problem, Lucy. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Following the Rules with Lucy McNulty. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd be very grateful if you could rate, review, and subscribe on all the usual channels. It helps other people get to know us too.